Welcome to the Totem Figures Podcast. I'm TJ Daw. Ivan E. Coyote tells stories, performs spoken word, puts out CDs, publishes short stories. She's got a novel and a regular column she's been writing for more than 10 years for Extra newspaper. Her totems include Bill Cosby, Sherman Alexie, Barbara Gowdy, Rufus Wainwright, Tom Spanbauer, Veda Hilly, and Laurie Anderson. We started off talking about Bill Cosby.
I like Bill Cosby, and I know that's kind of cheesy, but he was sort of a trailblazer, and I think he's interesting. I like people who have the ability to trailblaze in a way by kind of sneaking under people's radar so that they don't really realize how kind of radical they are in a way. Like, Bill Cosby's radical because he's not radical. The black comics that were operating at his time were kind of, they were sort of more out there, and they were really foul-mouthed, and that was good. It was pushing the genre in a certain way. But he mainstreamed himself right into the middle of, like, white American households. He blazed his own way into places that black people in America weren't getting to yet. And he's still very vocal about black culture in the States and what that looks like and what kind of a face they're putting forward. Like, he kind of says to his own folks, like, you know, clean up your act a little bit and, you know, do we really want to be known for, you know, bitch this, fuck that. And also that record, when I was a kid, we had a really good stereo. You know, very few records, though. Like, my parents weren't big record buyers. So the records that I did have access to as a kid, I listened to a lot. And it was Noah Building the Ark.
Noah. Who is that? It's the Lord, Noah. Right. Where I am. What do you want? I've been good. I want you to build an ark. Right. What's an ark? Get some wood, build it 300 cubits by 80 cubits by 40 cubits. Right. What's a cubit?
And I just, like, I don't know how many times I must have listened to that on our front, on our rug in the living room, and it always just cracked me up. So I feel like he was an early influence. And the thing I like about him is he's still around. Like, he's still here and still doing stuff. Maybe it's not, like, the greatest stuff of his whole career or whatever, but...
But it's quite a career.
It's quite a career. Like, yeah
really,
like,
no dips.
40 years.
Oh, more than that.
Maybe.
Since the early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah, okay. Yeah, so staying power. Bill Cosby for staying power. You know, not that he was ever the edgiest guy, but in a way, that's what makes him edgy in my mind, because he could take things to places where the other guys couldn't go.
And because of my father, between the ages 7 through 15, I thought my name was Jesus Christ. The Jesus Christ! And my brother Russell thought his name was Dammit. Dammit, will you stop all that noise? And Jesus Christ, sit down! So one day I'm out playing in the rain. My father said, Dammit, will you get in here? I said, Dad, I'm Jesus Christ.
I like him because I sort of feel like I'm like that in a way, too. Not that I'm like Bill Cosby or anything like that, but... But I go to small little towns where other queer or gay or whatever performers would be like, what? You're doing a gig in Powell River? And I'd be like, yeah, not only am I doing a gig in Powell River, I'm selling out a 400-seat theater, and I'm getting a standing ovation in a 400-seat theater in Powell River, which is a little blue-collar mill town, and I'll sell $900 worth of queer books. But I know what I'm doing. I'll walk out onto the stage and they'll be like, what's going on? And then go, now to tell a story about my father, who's a welder. It could be any one of those guys out there. And a respectful story. Funny's good. but a story that honors the, you know, kind of the working class blue collar dude, and get them on my side, and then go, oh, sounds like my dad. And yeah, so do, you know, get them all on my side and get them relaxed, and then later on in the set, it's like, okay, so now that we all like each other, now I'll push the envelope a little bit.
Let's go somewhere you've never been before.
Yeah, but let's go somewhere that you've never been before in a boat that you recognize.
I like a little bit of egg, potato, and bacon in every bite of my breakfast. Is it finally time for a show? Constantly being weighed and adjusted throughout the meal. There's nothing worse, eh, than ending up with only hash browns in the end. Always let your engine warm up a little, son, before you drop it anywhere. Let it run and cool down for a little bit before you turn it off. You can double. Are you listening? You can double that gear more. You learn how to treat it right, driving faster. Burns more gas.
Yeah.
Plus, all you hard on the brakes. All you end up doing is waiting longer for the light to turn green. Never go grocery shopping on an empty stomach. What are you, some form of idiot? All of these things I learned from my father, and most of the time I do them without even thinking about him, but every once in a while I stop and I remember these are inherited traits. These are passed down habits. Other fathers might have saved their bacon till last. Might let their truck run out of gas every once in a while. Might have hired someone else to build their house for them. Other fathers might have worn dress shoes to work instead of steel-toed boots. A different kind of dad. Might not have taught me how to weld. Man with sons might not have let his daughter drive the forklift. Who would I be right now if he had been anybody else?
Yeah, so I like Bill Cosby for that, because I think he sort of did that. And I like the full-on edgy, you know, envelope pushers, in-your-face kind of artists. I totally respect that. I think it's part of the whole process of social change, and I fully get that. But I think over the long run, I couldn't see myself being that in someone's face and doing it for 50 years. It would almost be like, it would become a caricature. Anyway, Bill Cosby. Barbara Gowdy. We So Seldom Look on Love was a huge influence for me as a writer. Short stories, and there's just something so sort of pedestrian about her macabre-ness. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but I like her. I think she's a strong writer, and she's another one who, you know, you're not going to get three paragraphs in and go, oh, this is Barbara Gowdy. She's always sort of chameleoning a little up a little bit, even now in her writing, and she's another one who's been at it for a long time now, so she would be on my list. Tom Spanbauer, he's a gay American, I think he might be from New York. He wrote Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon. It's set at the turn of the century, and it's kind of in a frontier town in California somewhere, like a gold rush town, and it's the story of sort of like a transgendered half-breed cowboy whore who lives in a shack. They call him out in the shed. They save him for special for the cowboy who's looking for a little something out of the ordinary. There's such a narrative departure. And funny enough, for someone who's a storyteller and who's obsessed with the sound of sentences and the rhythm, the musical rhythm of language and word structure, you cannot read that book out loud. It's impossible. There's something about it. I can't read it out loud, and I can read, no, like not to brag, but I can read from a phone book and make it sound vaguely interesting because I've done so much public performance in my day. It's really hard, I know, because I've tried to read parts out loud over the years to lovers when I was trying to woo people and stuff.
And why?
I don't know. It's just something about the pace of the narrative. But that's what I like about it, is that it's got this completely unique narrative rhythm. I like him too because he's a gay male writer, and his characters are all genders and sorts. And I like queerness that's not apologetic, but I like queerness that's not the be-all and end-all of the story. I like it when it's incidental or accidental, or just like it is in real life, like some of us are just are, and some of us just aren't, and it doesn't have to be the heart of the story. It's just part of the story.
Kind of like Bill Cosby being black.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, he doesn't lead with that, really. No. He tells stories about being a kid.
Yeah.
Or being a dad.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean where I think his revolutionary power came from, because when he first started doing it, to be a black comic was, and everyone else who was a black comic was that, they were a black comic.
And to this day,
yeah,
many comedians with anything like that going for them, mm-hmm. whether they're queer or Hispanic,
yeah,
or anything, mm-hmm. or just a woman,
yeah,
their material will
especially
always be
the
about
women.
That.
And I mean, I have a lot of queer subtext and queer text and queer things in there in my work too. But a lot of my stuff isn't, you know, like
just about
I
human experience.
Just about human experience, and that's just part of the story, and that's why I like Tom Spanbauer's characters, because they're just part of the story, you know, and people are really unboxable too.
So that's kind of a revolutionary thing that it sounds like he's doing and Bill Cosby's doing.
In my mind, I mean, some people would say, oh, it's not that Bill Cosby, what's revolutionary about him? He's like, you know, Mr. Huxtable or whatever, like how fucking boring. But, and not that I think like, oh, middle class black America is so revolutionary. Like, I'm white, as you can see. Well, you can't on there, but I'm as white as, like, I'm pasty, actually. But I'm interested in, artists who I feel like have the ability to really bring people together and make us understand our neighbors, whether they're familiar to us or not. And then some other people will say, oh, like, oh, people have crossover appeal, or, you know, oh, like, white people can handle it because it doesn't, you know, threaten them, or they don't have to look at their own racism. And those are valid arguments. I also think that Bill Cosby went into a lot of white people's houses through their televisions. I was a little kid in the Yukon listening to a record, and that guy cracked me up. And I honestly didn't care what color he was. Even as a little kid in the North at the time, in the 60s and 70s, when I grew up, was fucking racist. Mostly towards First Nations. And racist in that way of, like, having no... Like, we had one black kid in our school. We had two Filipino brothers, and, like, one Chinese family. And then it was white and First Nations. And we were taught as very young kids that never the twain shall meet.
So who bought that Bill Cosby album?
My parents bought that Bill Cosby album. My dad fucking loved Bill Cosby. He liked comedy records, and he just bought Bill Cosby because he was funny, you know?
So again, that's a subversive way to reach a lot of people. It's just to be really funny. Just to be really good.
Yeah. Rufus Wainwright? Fucking love that guy. He has such a distinctive voice, like two notes out of that guy's mouth, and you know that it's him, no matter if he's playing with Elton John or a fucking symphony orchestra. I like him because, like, the first time I saw him was at the Railway Club. He was a friend of a friend of mine's, and I went to go see him. So he seemed real to me somehow. Like, when I see Elton John calling the finest songwriter living in the world today, he seems like a real guy to me. And, you know, and he had his fuck-ups and shit like that. I think he had a little crystal meth problem or something for a while. And to me, that just, as an artist, it just makes me be able to relate to them, because I, not that I had a crystal meth problem, it's one of the only ones I managed to avoid, but yeah, he just seemed really human to me, and I think he's a fine, fine songwriter, I really do, and I think he's got a great voice.
Does his humanity come across in his songwriting, in his performance?
To me it does, because I had that, you know, saw him, went for a beer with my friend and him afterwards, and he was just a normal dude, and he seemed really quite sweet.
But is that the kind of thing you can recognize listening to any of the albums you've heard that have come out since then?
I would. I don't know if anyone else could, but I hear it. Like, that's what I have. I collect that history. with his songs, right? And I also like him because he's gay, and it's just a thing. It's not the be-all and end-all of everything. And
okay.
It's not, like, I like knowing that some of those love songs that he sings are for boys, probably pretty little boys with, like, twinky designer shirts and skinny jeans on, but anyone can listen to them and still hear a love song. I like that. Veda Hilly, I like her because her work is really rooted in the place that it comes from. A lot of her Vancouver stuff, and then she's written several albums about the Yukon. The first two notes on a piano, and I'll know it's Veda.
Something that you said specifically that you didn't get out of Barbara Gatti, that you couldn't tell that it was her, like from the first couple of paragraphs.
Yep. As a writer, yeah, I liked that about Barbara Gatti, that she's always kind of doing new stuff, writing-wise. Yeah, musicians are sort of different though, because like they're all just working with those 12 notes, right? I like Rufus because of that too, that I can tell right away that it's his voice, even if it's. Like, even when I was listening to Anthony and the Johnsons, and I was like, hang on a sec, that's Rufus Wainwright singing backups, isn't it? And go to the CD liner notes, and sure enough, right? And he's singing backups, and I could recognize him. And Veda I like her because she's unapologetically an artist that does what she wants. To her own detriment, financially, but she maintains her own artistic vision, and in that way she is like Barbara Gowdy, because I can always tell it's Veda, but that doesn't mean that the songs are all going to sound the same. That doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to be like, oh yeah, this sounds like, you know, she won't even play her old stuff that I used to really love listening to. Like, she won't play Precious Heart. Maybe if we're drunk one night in a hotel room and I ask her really nice, she will, but she won't do it for a live crowd like any of her really old stuff usually.
Precious, look down, there are your feet. You're on.
Because she's always moving forward.
She just has new stuff that she wants to do.
Yeah. And that's more interesting to her.
I guess so, I don't know.
Always exploring.
Yep.
So another person who's last.
Well, that's what I like about her, too, yeah, is that here she still is, right?
And she's not playing the same old songs from when she first started putting out albums.
Oh, God,
which
no.
Which a lot of musicians do, or a lot have to do, because that's what the audience wants.
There's hundreds of songs that I know all the lyrics to of hers that she's forgotten. That's a true story. We were hanging out at her place one day, and she was playing piano, and I was like, play this one. She's like, I don't remember how it goes. And I started singing the lyrics to so, is that? Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's how it goes. Trust me, I know. And I just think she keeps getting better and better and better, too. Like, from an artist building block perspective, Veda Hilly is the finest songwriter in Canada today. Okay. I think that. That doesn't mean that she's going to sell the most records, or that there's not other songs that I don't like, but in terms of complexity and true craft and, instrumentation and arrangement, she's got her own thing going on. Tuk Toyak Tuk Him is one of my favorite songs of hers. I think she borrowed the part, like the bare bones of the hymn from an old traditional hymn and then made it new. But I like that song, not because of what we were just talking about, because it's a simpler song arrangement-wise, I think. Again, it's all the connections I have with that song. Like, it was written for the North, it's written for a northern town.
Jesus, where'er thy people meet, there they behold thy mercy seat. There'er they seek thee, thou art found, and every place is hallowed ground.
I've sung it at the Yukon Art Center for the Longest Night Festival with the full orchestra, with her, like, all of us singing together in harmony. I've also gotten really stoned at the top of Grey Mountain and cranked it in my mom's Ford Explorer and, you know, laid on the hood and cried my head off because it was just so pretty with the hot engine underneath me. And then when I looked up, there was a fox standing right there looking at me, trying to eat my cherry pits that I'd thrown on the ground a couple of minutes before. Shit like that, you know. Like, that that shit runs deep, man.
It's dark, it's cold and long. We call thee, Lord, we bid thee come. White crosses in our graveyard stand. Protect us in thy
Tell me something more about Sherman White. How did you get into this stuff?
Oh, I heard about him on the radio. I'm a big CBC radio fan. I'd heard about him before and I sort of knew who he was. And I kind of peripherally follow other writers who are good, strong performers because often the skill set doesn't necessarily overlap. And I'd heard that he was a really good public speaker. And then, I heard him on Writers and Company and he was just so smart. And again, he was talking about his relationship with his father. And I was cooking something. I think I was making Chipotle chicken, which is this really wicked dish that I cook. So it involves a lot of prep and chopping and deboning and whatnot. And so I was cooking and had the CBC on, and it was like a wintry, cold day. And I was really struck by his relationship to his father and how he could have been me talking about my relationship with my own father. So I wrote down the name of the poem that he was reading. And I knew he was a First Nations. Well, I think he's not Canadian, he's American, so like an Indigenous American Indian writer. So I went out, and my girlfriend and I went out and bought a couple of his books. I think they're... I just was really struck by not so much what he was teaching me about his culture, but how much we had in common. How much his relationship with his family resonated with me. And I also think he is a guy who uses humor to go places where, like, didactic political rants or even satire might not go.
But that's kind of like Bill Cosby.
Yeah, kind of, maybe, yeah.
Using humor to get the message out there.
Yep,
and emphasizing what we all have in common rather than what splits us apart.
But at that said, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian is a story about a young boy who decides that he can't live on the reservation. He wants to go get bussed out to school in the white school. And, I mean, it is about racism. He's not pulling any punches. It's totally about racism. And I read it and I thought, like, growing up as a kid, you know, who was going to school with, starting out, a lot of First Nations kids in kindergarten and grade 1 and grade 2, and then not seeing so many that graduated and never really knowing the reason for that, what the reason for that was, because, well, being taught racism, basically, being taught, you know, I mean, luckily I've, you know, unlearned a lot of that in my adult life, but I've basically thought, I still think that book should be required reading in high schools.
In order to foster understanding?
Yeah, in order to foster understanding, and it's also funny and it's accessible. All the kids can relate to the main character, First Nations or not. And it's funny because I just did a gig in Hope. I do a lot of high school shows, and they had just pulled the book from the reading list because one of the parents complained because, get this, horror of horrors, there was a masturbation scene, because Lord knows we can't have teenage boys talking about jerking off, like,
because then they might start doing it.
Yeah, like, who knows where that could lead. Right, who knows what kind of societal unrest that might foster. Jesus. Anyway,
Tell me something more about Laurie Anderson.
Too good to you, here come the plane. Thank you.
you better get ready.
How did you get into her?
Oh, I just... probably some woman I was dating, usually. And again, like, I just think she's an innovator. I think she uses text and music in really interesting ways, and always is kind of reinventing what she's doing. And I think, like, I didn't realize this when I was putting my list together, but I guess I really like artists who have staying power. And maybe that's because I'm facing down, like, my 20th year pretty quick coming up of being on the road. I'm late to write my column my column's late that I've been writing for going on 10 years once a month. So I'm looking for artists who can stick around and who are committed, because, you know, you gotta ride the raft sometimes, right? Sometimes the water's high, sometimes the water's low, sometimes it's full of sticks, sometimes it's full of rocks, sometimes it's pretty sweet. And those are the artists who are sticking around. They're sticking it out for the good reasons. They have to be, or they would have gone back to night school.
And would you say the same thing about yourself?
I hope so. Yep. Book number 7's about to come out. CD number 3. 4 short films, 10 years of columns. I do an average of over 200 shows a year.
And do you feel like you still have new things to say?
Oh, fuck yeah.
For more information on Ivan E. Coyote's books, stories, CDs, columns, performances, videos, and blog, go to ivanecoyote.com. I'm TJ Daw, and this has been a Totem Figures podcast.
No food, show straight, he's cool.